You know what? When it comes to technology or even medical devices, it takes, I think, 15 to 20 years before something becomes a standard of practice. And I think this is what's happening with DIGAS at the moment. So we are still in a trial and error phase of this because we've got several competing interests here. So the interest of the countries is to give access to patients to these solutions and create reimbursement, but also to contain costs.
Welcome to Health Tech Central, the podcast that connects you with the wisdom of trailblazers at the intersection of health, care and technology. 42-ish minutes of entertaining inspiration, actionable insights and answers to just about everything. Hitchhiking most definitely allowed. With your host, Mehdi Khaled.
Hello, everyone. She's one of my heroes, a journalist with a background in health management and economics. She's the main face behind Faces of Digital Health podcast and has been leading interesting health and digital health debates with interesting people. Her name is Chiasa Saic, and I'm pleased to have her on the show with me today. Hi, Chiasa, and welcome to Health Tech Central.
Hi, Mehdi, and thank you for having me. I look forward to the discussion.
The format of our show is always we start by our guests telling us some anecdotes, some funny moments they've had through their lives, because we live in an industry and work in an industry that is actually very serious by nature. So I want to break the ice by telling some funny stories. If you have one to share with us, that'd be great.
Okay. So I'm a journalist by background, and I've been working in healthcare IT for the last 7 years, but I started covering digital health in 2015. And obviously, at the beginning, my key motivation was, as a chronic patient, I wanted to understand, you know, how the data flows and why things work or don't work. But I really didn't have that much of an insight into healthcare IT. So I remember talking to Angé Drolz from Better during coffee, and I was asking him, you know, what the company does and what their plans are and how healthcare IT works in the hospital. And he's like, well, you know, hospitals are transitioning from paper to digital. You have to go through this whole digital transformation. But the key thing is that you optimize processes, and that's the hardest part. And I thought, well, okay, so when you optimize things, what do you do then? Because I didn't have that context, you know. I thought it was just, it's a project, you do it, that's fine. And now, yeah, you know, after 10 years, I definitely understand that that was potentially a little bit of a silly question, because the optimization is a never-ending process, especially with the advancements in technology and innovation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it's not only you, though. It's even doctors who are embarking in the digital health journey. I have this question, you know, very often coming up in discussions. They say, okay, it's about application. So we really see things at the very superficial level at the beginning. And then the more you go into it, the more complicated it gets, the more depths and layers it gets. And it's, I think, what makes it very interesting and challenging at the same time.
Yeah, I think the main challenge is, how do you explain the public in as lay terms as possible how complex healthcare IT is and why things are moving so slowly? Because, you know, we are so deep into these details on a daily basis that we don't understand what the public doesn't understand. So from time to time, it's good to just speak to a neighbor, somebody who's not in healthcare at all, and see how they perceive the issues. And that can really help you shape how you think about what should be changed next.
Yeah, involving all the actors and engagement is very important. We often actually talk about user engagement and user feedback, etc. But, you know, in the chain of digital health happenings, what I've noticed as a physician who moved actually to the health IT many years ago is very seldom patients actually who are the ultimate users of the systems of any implementation we do are very seldomly asked about user friendliness. And it's not, now they're coming big time back into the equation. But before, I'm talking like 10 years ago, they seldomly ask if things work for them the way they expect them to be. And so, but we're getting there, I guess. You've been covering quite some events lately, and I've been following you, obviously, on LinkedIn and your podcast. And what do you think the main innovations were in the last, let's say, 3 or 4 years?
Well, one topic I would say that has been quite central to digital health are digital therapeutics. And the interesting thing there is the importance of politics in the whole story, at least from my perspective. You know, if Jens Spahn wasn't a stubborn politician and a leader who decided to push for DGAS, even though the clinicians or the clinical audience was against this, we might not have been talking about PECAN today. We might not even consider that this is something that the field can invest in. So the fact that Germany started with this brought a lot of hope that actually these digital applications or digital interventions for healthcare have a bright future, and that there is a return on investment, and that technology can be impactful with complementing pharmaceuticals or even replacing pharmaceuticals. What I think has been apparent throughout the last 3 years is that actually, as it often happens in healthcare, it is more difficult than we thought. The DGAS were a success from the legislation perspective, but the adoption is still a huge, huge hurdle. And we still have a lot of work to do in that sense, because digital health startups just don't have the marketing budgets to raise the awareness among the general public, to raise the awareness among clinicians, to create tools and regulatory mechanisms that would make it easy for clinicians to choose between solutions. So there's still a lot of challenges that we need to overcome. That's one. Then the second one that I see rising a lot in the digital health space is the awareness about the importance of women's health, innovation in the women's health space, beyond just reproduction and menopause, but also the differences in brain health, the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease that's higher among women than men, the fact that cardiovascular diseases present differently in the male and female populations. So all those gender specifics, and also the requirements for clinical studies to be balanced in the gender, are also one big topic that's kind of rising up. And maybe the third one that we don't see in Europe just yet, but it's been present in the US for the last 3 years, is food as medicine. You could look at it from two ways. One is another field that the US population has found a way to make a business of. I'm saying that because if you look at general diets in the Mediterranean, or generally speaking in schools here in Europe, we have what could be considered healthy options in many cases. So that's kind of normal to us. But the speed of life is kind of forcing us into fast choices. So the things that should be natural to us, so to take time for meals, to cook at home, are now being turned into a product because the lifestyle has changed so much that it's not normal to do things that used to be normal and contributed to a healthy life, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense, especially in the context of microbiome research has taken up quite significantly in the last couple of years, and quite some interesting findings have come to light in relation to, say, the level of health from your microbiome will determine anybody's level of resilience. This has been published a couple of weeks ago. So it goes way beyond diseases. The healthier microbiome profile you get, the more resilient you get, then maybe they will affect other areas which we don't know about yet. So it's very interesting that you mentioned nutrition, because it ties quite nicely to the latest findings in microbiome research. And then I want to tie two things together. Like, you've gone public about you being an IBD patient, inflammatory bowel disease patient, a few years back. But then, you know, if you tie these two together, like DTX, the digital therapeutics, with the application of eating healthier food and, you know, having a healthier lifestyle, etc., where do you think this is going?
So I think that digitalization, and this is just me talking about my personal experience and my personal opinion, and you know how it is, when you see one patient, so everybody's different, and this can be generalized. But definitely from my experience, the problem with chronic patients, pain and disease in general, is that when you're in immediate pain or when something is new, you're very receptive for interventions. So for new patients, they're hungry for information, they're hungry for solutions, they're very open to changes in lifestyle, etc. But when you live with a disease for 10, 20 or more years, it just becomes a part of you. I wouldn't say a partner, but it's just something that's normal to you. One of the things that is a symptom of a relapse in IBD is the presence of blood in stool. So, you know, in the beginning, when you get sick for the first time, that's super scary. after 20 years, it's like, okay, so this is happening again. I probably should do something. You don't. So the perception is quite different. And what digital therapeutics or digital solutions want is to gather as much data as possible. So if that means that I need to put the data in manually, that's not something that I'm going to use. And also after 20 years, my impression is that I know enough about the disease. So I'm not interested in using anything, quite frankly, unless, you know, I would have such a strong pain that would force me to rethink my my concerns. So DTX for this specific condition, I think, could be very useful in the early stages. After a while, after you figure out how you need to react, how you need to adapt your lifestyle, I don't see them as being very useful. But
yeah,
in the initial stages, yeah.
Makes a lot of sense because, as you know, the IBD patients initially experience a lot of anxiety. There is a lot of anxiety factor in the thing. And some of the applications or DTX applications that are on the market, they tend to purposely reduce that level of anxiety in patients. And some have been quite successful in doing that. Now,
yeah.
And
but if I just may add, you know, I guess, you know, when you're an IBD patient and when you get monitored quite often, that also means that you undergo regular colonoscopies. So, you know, if I have the worsening of IBD, my concern is always, is this going to turn into cancer? And no digital therapeutic can reduce that anxiety. The only thing that can reduce the anxiety is undergoing the colonoscopy and seeing that everything's okay. Because all the results are going to be good.
Yes. And it's interesting you talk about colonoscopy now moving into the liquid biopsy diagnostics area where increasingly we can actually detect a circulating tumor DNA in the blood without having to go and do biopsies or do colonoscopy. So one of the interesting areas of development right now is the ability to detect colon cancer before the actual solid tumor appears in the colon. With liquid biopsies, sensitivity
yeah.
and specificity of these tests are above 95%, 98%. So it's very accurate. So you know the good news and the bad news is maybe for IBD patients and other at-risk population of that particular risk of colon cancer, bowel cancer. Will benefit from less invasive and more accurate ways to diagnose and screen this at very early stages. So these are the good news.
This is already used in Switzerland a lot. I think that one of the Swiss companies is actually leading in this well. In this field, there's also Grail that can detect, I think, 30 or something cancers with a blood test. And the NHS did a study a few years ago with that. So that's definitely very welcome as a preventative measure for, to do that like once a year, especially if you're an at-risk population that can calm your mind.
Digital therapeutics and European Union, it's a very complex territory and it's a very complex process to get things approved. First, there are many hurdles, but the two main hurdles is to get your DTX approved and accredited. The second hurdle is to get it reimbursed. And when you get it reimbursed, it doesn't mean you stay on track of being reimbursed. You know, like the Kaya Health COPD app has been withdrawn from reimbursement just lately in Germany. It means that you have to fight for being reimbursed all the time. So these are massive hurdles that actually DTX companies, which are most of them are startups, are facing. So it's a very steep uphill battle. And then the third thing is the icing on the cake is when you have to deal with different legislations. You have the French DIGA, the German DIGA, they put a flag on it and you have to run across all these processes. How do you see this evolution, if you want? And how do you see there is an effort from the European Union to streamline these processes?
You know what? When it comes to technology or even medical devices, it takes, I think, 15 to 20 years before something becomes a standard of practice. And I think this is what's happening with DIGAs at the moment. So we are still in a trial and error phase of this because we've got several competing interests here. So the interest of the countries is to give access to patients to these solutions and create reimbursement, but also to contain costs. So what we see in France is that they, from the get-go, limited how much they're going to pay for the beacon applications from the beginning. So companies can know what they can expect from the market. In Germany, the story was a little bit different. So initially, companies can provide their own price, but after a year, the insurance company is going to assess if that price is correct or not. And so far, we've seen that prices have been slashed by half after the year. So it's a huge business issue for the companies, as you also already mentioned. But I always look at all these things from the patient perspective, you know, and the small country problem that we have, especially in Europe, you know, so it's 26 countries. There's people would usually go to the German and the French market because the market potential is higher and you need to create a sustainable business. But me as a patient coming from a 2 million nation country, I always feel left behind because I know from the business perspective, companies are not going to even be interested in coming to our country because the market is just too small. You know, there's not enough patients potentially, and the hurdles are just too big for the company to invest that impact into the market. And I think that's something that we don't often mention in these discussions, you know, this whole business perspective, the company perspective when it comes to scaling to different markets. It's healthcare IT or medtech businesses are not something you can buy off the shelf, even if the website is there. A country might even be willing to pay a company to implement their product on the market, but the company is just not going to do that because it's not going to scale. It's kind of a one-time, very expensive investment from the company perspective that they're not going to do because it makes more sense to go to Spain, France, Germany, and just get a better return on the investment of their employees that they will do. So that accessibility and I guess equity is a huge, huge issue also when we talk about these solutions. So it's good that I guess we also in DTX, we also shifted from simply thinking about making this prescription only therapies to this shift that maybe a B2C option is something that should be available. I think I saw more of this in the US where companies were prescription only and they became D2C products. So over the counter OTC.
Exactly.
Products.
So it's an OTC DTX basically. And that was exactly the line of thoughts I was trying to follow now in this discussion when you mentioned this. I see it as, I think that would be the answer to the regulations. That will be the answer to reaching out and most of all adoption. I personally see DTX moving into a territory of enabling self-care as opposed to being a prescription you have to adhere to. So I think from that perspective, there will be necessarily some redesign and redevelopment or readaptation of DTX as they are today. I think there needs to be a lot more flesh to it to enable self-care. Self-care, which as you know, Tyasha, is a massive topic. Only 10 countries are enabling self-care today on the planet. There's a phase one and phase two. There's a self-care foundation that has actually come up with a self-care index. So countries have self-care index that spans regulations and enablement and health educators, etc. And this will enable the reduction of burden of healthcare institutions and care delivery organizations to actually offload some of the care services to the patients, to the families, and to the communities. So I see DTX as an OTC, as an enabler to do that. It's one of the things that could massively help COPD patients, which we know, I'm saying COPD because the problem of COPD patients is oftentimes they also have diabetes. So it's a double whammy. They have two very heavy chronic diseases. And so the consumptions of healthcare services by these population of patients, sadly, is very high. And so if you offload some of the services to give them some means to educate and self-regulate and self-manage themselves, I mean, I'm not talking out of my opinion here. There are studies and impact studies that have been done. This could massively reduce the burden on hospitals and costs as well. So I think marrying over-the-counter DTX with some education content to help people manage, self-manage their own chronic conditions would be the way to go.
You opened up a lot of topics here. So one is, to which extent are people engaged in their own health? I think in the public systems, and I'm generalizing, you can disagree with that, but very often people are not, like, they take services for granted. So they also expect them to be free. And I'm just going to refer to a study that was done here in Slovenia, where they wanted to just, on a random population, they invited people to get tested for Helicobacter pylori, which is one of the causes of stomach cancer. And the response rate wasn't high enough, so the study could be conclusive, you know. So that engagement and that awareness is a huge barrier to success, especially in DTX. So we expect people to want to know this, and then they have to do a lot of research and understand a lot to be able to then decide on what they're going to use and even pay for it. So there's a huge issue there. And one thing, and I also like to emphasize that, you know, we may be skeptical about the efficacy of some digital therapeutics. They're very popular in mental health. But given all the shortages that we have with healthcare professionals, especially in mental health, I think this is better than nothing. You know, can we just start with what's better than nothing, which is what a lot of people are currently faced with, and see what the effect of that is? So I do believe that, you know, there is an opportunity for these solutions. But one thing that it is a really good point that was mentioned in a recent newsletter from Christina Farr, it was referring to Forward Health and the fact that, so Forward Health is this US company that created this very high-tech pods that were put into malls, and people for a $100 subscription could do regular medical checkups enabled by AI, and the doctor in the background would check if everything's okay. They closed their business down, but the key point was that we still want that human touch, and we hope that technology can solve a lot of problems, and investors hope that technology is going to solve a lot of problems, because technology scales more than services and people providing those services thus. So that's one of the big challenges, I guess, in healthcare digitalization and solutions such as DTX. And I think, you know, a few years ago when we started talking about DTX, they were defined as a standalone solution. So if it's not a standalone solution, it's not a DTX. But now it became clear that you more or less need that human intervention in the middle to be able to get to success. So I believe that, you know, if you have a therapist coupled with a DTX, so you can do something between the visits, there's a lot of potential in that between visits, interventions and time that patients would like to invest in, so they can even maybe accelerate the healing process that would either be longer if they just did that once a week or once a month or once every few weeks therapy.
The cultural aspect you mentioned at the beginning of this last bit was interesting, and it's fascinating to me, because I was at a conference lately, and one of the things I've said on the panel shocked everybody in the room in Austria here. And as you know, cultural difference in the perception of healthcare services and self-care, so much different between countries, that is quite striking. So a Singaporean would think, I have the duty to stay healthy, and they will do everything to stay healthy. And in Europe in general, they think, I have the right to be sick. And, you know, it's two worlds apart in terms of healthcare services consumption and the way we make people accountable for their own health. And by the way, when we talk about accountability, accountable healthcare, we most of the time omit two big parties there. Number one, the patient. We always put accountability on the healthcare provider, which is only half the truth. And the big other omitted party is the insurances. And so the next, part of the discussion I want to maybe take a little deeper dive in. We're moving more and more, we're inching more and more toward preventive care, accountable care, value-based care. But we see this movement being very, very slow in Europe. It's adopted by some pockets of healthcare systems in the US. We know them, they're known, Kaiser, Geisinger, you name it. And very few actors in Europe. You have Ribera Salud in Spain, you have just now launched in 2024, Réseau de l'Arc Jurassien near Bern in Switzerland. And these are beacons of hope for the European healthcare system. So where do you see technology onboarding these missing actors, the patients, to become more accountable? And most of all, the insurances that kind of should actually pay more for preventive services or preventive care rather than pay-per-service. And when you see, I'll give you one more information. When you see a Barmer, which is a healthcare insurance in Germany, they're very much invested in preventive care. Yet, when you talk to these insurances about let's do something that will actually help and boost prevention, they're very reluctant, even though the numbers are there. So why do you think this is so? It's interesting to me.
I guess we could look at it from several aspects. One is that actually what in many cases seems most sensible is secondary prevention. So focusing on the patients that are already the costliest and making sure that they don't have a relapse, that they don't have even worsening or additional comorbidities. So I think that that's a good way to start. It's that cultural component is very important. You know, if people feel entitled to care, then they might be more prone to reactive healthcare, which is something that we often hear as a negative of the current healthcare delivery. We say that healthcare delivery is too reactive, not enough preventative, but we very rarely talk about how open are the people to preventative approaches. And there's various ways that you can do prevention. You know, it can be through the screening programs that you have for cervical cancer, colon cancer, and hope that, you know, people are going to respond. I think 70% of people need to respond for the program to be successful. And in many cases, that's not the issue. Where I hope that technology can do more is that through digitizing healthcare records, through having a better understanding of individual patients, we can actually do more targeted prevention. We could already do a lot of that through just analyzing insurance claims and risk scoring of patients based on similar patient journeys. So, for example, if you have billings of two patients that are similar, but one is, say, 10 years older and has undergone through several others comorbidities or complications on a population level, you could predict that another patient that's lower down the line might be subjected to something similar, and then you can target prevention based on that. And to a degree, I know that some countries are already doing this. Catalonia has a special risk scoring group of epidemiologists that are trying to give that information to clinicians. So that's one potential that I think is going to lead to better outcomes and maybe some cost containment in healthcare. But the second consequence of this whole narrative that the patient is responsible, it's your fault, is also a little bit intimidating, at least for me. And this is, again, my personal experience. You know, especially with chronic diseases and autoimmune diseases, there's this very strong awareness that a lot is dependent on the mental health of an individual. So it's kind of, you're almost blamed of creating a disease because of, you know, the connection between the brain, mental health, and physical health. So I always almost feel bad if I get sick. Like, what did I do wrong? What should I do wrong? Because I feel that I need to be this informed patient. I also feel that I need to come super prepared to all the healthcare meetings. And what happened to me last year is, you know, I came to one of the checkups because I had really strong chest pain. I did a lot of research. I said to my GP, I think this might be the problem. And she said, well, yeah, this might be the problem. So that's why I'm going to refer you to a gastroenterologist. And I came to a gastroenterologist and I said, I have this. And he was like, says who? And then I realized, well, actually, it's Google and ChatGPT. So, you know, I was already convinced that I'm here. I know what the problem is. So let's just fix it. And the doctor has the mindset, okay, well, that's the theory. Let's do the tests. Let's check. We still have to figure out and confirm that theory. And that theory turned out to be wrong. So there's a lot of aspects here into which extent can patients use technology and when is technology useful. And, you know, what if technology tells you that everything's okay with you and it's not, and you just rely on that? I think we often say how men are reluctant to visit clinicians, and you're going to have patient stories when men will say, I only went because I wanted my wife to stop nagging me. And then it turned out that it was really valid for that person to go to the doctors. So it's a huge topic that involves psychology, that involves culture, and is specific for each country. So we have to be very careful when we think about how we use prevention. Another, for example, challenge is how do you do prevention for lung cancer? And okay, so you could do MRIs or CT scans, which is some of the things that I think are currently considered. But how do you even identify patients if smoking is so stigmatized that most people that smoke won't accurately tell their doctors how much they smoke and for how long they smoke? So again, instead of finding that population that's most at risk, you might spend a lot of money on prevention and tests for the worried smokers that are not as risky as the ones that have been smoking for 20 years. So again, we have a lot of work to do also in this aspect of making sure that the same way that we say that if a doctor makes a mistake, let's look at the process and where the process went wrong, not that individual patient. I think when we talk about the patient accountability, we also need to kind of take that into account a little bit, you know, that people that are aware don't feel guilty for getting sick and burdening the healthcare system.
Fully agree with you. And I need to make a little adjustment to my statement that when I'm saying the patient needs to be accountable for their own health, I was mostly talking about lifestyle choices, basically to not get into a chronic condition. I'm not talking about patients who acquire certain chronic conditions based on their genetics or environmental factors that they are not in control of. And so the lifestyle choices are related to many of the chronic conditions that are avoidable today. You know, COPD is tightly related to cigarette smoking. Diabetes as well. There you have a genetic factor, but you know that the epigenetics work in a way that it can delay the onset of certain diseases if you don't expose those genes to be expressed. Basically, obesity, lifestyle, physical activity, etc. And so I was more talking about the healthcare education part of the equation, which is super important. And I think with the digitization of everyone on the planet, maybe 90% of people have already access to smartphones and internet and information. I think a lot more effort could and should be done by, I would say, all the healthcare educators and governments to educate the population more and avoid these things. I mean, I know it's a wishful thinking. We're still in the sick care process. And
I'm gonna take a bit of a compassionate stance here, because it's one thing to know what you're supposed to do. It's a completely different thing doing that, you know, because life is stressful, life is busy. And even with smoking, it's an addiction. It's really difficult to stop smoking, to stop drinking. So I think many people understand that this is bad, but they're just too physically dependent on that. And usually that's also a lot of environmental factors, the society, the conditions of living, their social status that basically impacts that and basically triumphs what's good for them from just the existence point of view and how long they're going to live. And
so the aspect that to me is very important is the way digital data is going to be used in Europe across the nations with the European health data space. Something that I wanted to have your opinion on. How do you see this unfolding? I have to say, though, that the EHDS is an innovation per se. I see it as an innovation because it's something that is new, something that is useful, something that has potential. And I think the time to adoption and time to value will be quite challenging because European countries are at different levels of maturity in terms of digitization. We know Germany is very far. But where do you see the low-hanging fruits of EHDS?
I'm going to frame it a little bit differently. I think that we are very impatient with EHDS when actually this is a process that has been ongoing for the last 30 years. We're just starting to call it EHDS now. It's very difficult to create cross-border, cross-culture, cross-language agreement on how things are supposed to be done. And data standards and codification of things is very crucial here. So I'm hoping that, you know, the international patient summary is slowly going to scale across nations. There, you can already check on the website which countries are exchanging parts of data. So EHDS is not something that's not here today and it's going to be here in 2026. It's really, really slowly and gradually developing. I see a lot of potential in open data standards and vendor neutral standards, and open air as a vendor neutral standard, clinically led and very granular in the clinical capture of the relevant data points, is one that is gaining quite significant footprint in Europe. So I think it's going from something that a quite big community of over 120 countries believes in, into something that is now being adopted in Switzerland, in the UK, in Spain, in Slovenia, and more broadly. And at the last Open Air International Annual Conference, they did a hackathon where they used the International Patient Summary based on Open Air to build applications on top. So I think that's one of the discussions that I'm kind of keeping an eye on how it's going to be developing. It's very welcome for me to see that the discussion around data standards is turning into a more focus on collaboration and how the different standards complement each other. A few years ago, there was more rivalry among data standards. That's at least what I've observed. So we'll see where things go. I'm optimistic, but we'll just wait and see. But it's a long process. The biggest challenge in technology is always how do we as humans agree what makes sense and not. And this is where the opinions differ, and the whole debate on what's the right approach becomes a little bit philosophical. So let's see where these discussions go.
Tell you a story. The data, Open Air is obviously also a data model, right? It's a very complete data model based on archetypes, etc. And so when I was living in Asia and traveling quite frequently to Japan, maybe once a month I was in Japan, there were 120 health exchange projects in Japan, because university hospitals are tied to universities and data models developed by their universities are kind of a religion. So there were like 120 exchange data model religions in Japan. And now over time, like 15 years later, we see this data model picking up steam, although it's a very mature data model. It's been developed like 20 years ago. It's not new. And when I look at the European health data space, the original design of the European health data space has not taken into consideration the Open Air as a data standard, or not even mentioned it. But now we see a different dynamic, that countries who have adopted the Open Air as a standard data model or persistence layer, the standard is coming outside in and not inside out. And it's an interesting dynamic to observe for me. It's going to be interesting to see where the adoption lands and what the value will be. We know the value because of the richness of the data model, and you can expand and you can build applications on top of that. But the EHDS with the Open Air as a data model behind it as a persistence layer will be interesting to watch.
I think one thing to add, maybe in terms of the data standards and just like this alignment on what's good and what not, is also the governance. Data governance is one topic that is crucial when it comes to cybersecurity, when it comes to healthcare IT adoption and digital transformation. And an interesting component of that is the urgency when you need to record something in a digital form. So for example, Heather Leslie at the Open Air International Conference was mentioning this example of monkeypox. So, you know, when you have a pandemic or something and that spreads fast, you just want to somehow manage it. And there were 19 different ways that kind of popped up of saying, of saying that a person is dead. So, and the thing is, it was not that anyone didn't want to comply with the standard or with the standards, but it's when you have a problem in front of you, when you're in the ER, you just have to solve the problem that's in front of you. And that can be done through workarounds or whatever, just to come to the final, some sort of data. So it's not that people don't want to align. It's just that there's various factors that contribute to that alignment and not alignment that happens. It's kind of like with all the digital solutions, I always see that there's this huge gap between here's the patient and here's all the digital technology that could help that patient. And how do you bridge this huge gap between patient finding the right thing and knowing about something and all the solutions that are in theory already there, you know? So for example, I work in digital health space. I monitor the trends. So I know a few things. And just because of this fact, I have some sort of an advantage. But imagine if I'm somebody that is completely outside of healthcare and I try to understand what the next step should be and are possible based on the current technological options, before I figure everything out, it's like days, months pass. So this data governance, how to really enable easy search of information is one very crucial issue. And I think generative AI actually, especially since it's connected to the internet, is bringing a lot to the field to just give us ideas on what the possibilities and options that exist are.
And I think as well, and aligned with your thoughts, the word meaningfulness or meaningful use are increasingly important in times where we see, like I'm following like you do, Gary Monk, and all the innovations and all the stuff that's coming out every week. It's overwhelming. And mm-hmm. So if you're not educated, if you don't know your context and the needs of your system, it can be quite overwhelming to look through this and say, okay, I need to buy everything. You can't. And even if you do, you implement it and the adoption, which is a critical success factor, plus the impact behind that is not there. And so it becomes very quickly confusing to see all these new technologies and great innovations, by the way, happening. And I think the level of understanding and education of the decision makers, plus the governance you were talking about, to make sure, what do we need? Do we really need it? If we need technology, does it have to be an app? Can it be something else? So everybody's jumping on the app bandwagon right now. Everybody. There you see in even the national digital health strategies everywhere, especially in the Middle East. Everybody's developing an app of some sort. I think we need to, in the governance process and in the what we call the gating process, to understand the criteria based on your own contextual settings. What do you need? Sometimes the solutions are not digital. Sometimes the solutions are just a bunch of communications or communiques or some information spread on the websites, etc. And so I think there is a razor thin line of decision making that definitely tie into a very good governance process to make sure that we implement, we buy, we adopt, and we invest in meaningful technologies that are really relevant for us in our current context. I think that's something that some countries are not doing for sure, buying ad hoc technologies just for the sake of it. And increasingly more countries are doing a due diligence process to make sure that anything that's adopted really makes sense and the ROI in terms of impact on healthcare is there. Tyasha, last thoughts, recommendations, do's and don'ts. And, you know, if you are to advise, say, a decision maker, an insurance, about adopting technology, buying technology, investing in technologies in healthcare, what would that be?
So I'm actually going to just turn on my patient advocacy hat here. I love the book, Your Life Depends on It, from Talia Miron-Schatz, which basically emphasizes how to prepare for medical visits. And you need to practice three questions. And that is, well, whatever it is, if it's a procedure that you're about to undergo, if it's a new treatment that you're about to be recommended, always ask, what are the risks, what are the benefits, and what are the alternatives? Because, you know, when you're in a very specific emotional state, when you go into a doctor's office, and I think the statistics say that, I don't know, 50 to 80% of things that the doctor tells you, you just don't remember. So just having these three things in mind is a very good reminder to make the most out of the time that you have with the clinician. And additionally, now with generative AI, you can level up that preparation by telling Gen AI what your issues are without, you know, personal identifiable information, and just ask what you should ask the clinician. So patient advocates Grace Vinton and Grace Cordovano mentioned this in one of the previous episodes that I did for Faces of Digital Health. AI might hallucinate, you know, so you wouldn't necessarily want to use it for diagnosis, but you could use it for ideas on questions that you might want to ask your clinician. So that's where you can start to be a more informed patient, to make the most out of the time that you have with your clinician, and not leave the appointment feeling or remembering that there's three things that you forgot to ask, and it's going to take another 6 to 9 months before you can actually get in touch with that clinician again. So that would be it.
Thank you very much for being with me today. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Tyasha.
Thank you for the invitation.
This has been Health Tech Central. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast channel and give us a rating or review. Finally, you can check out our news on healthtechcentral.io and inspire us with your feedback. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next exciting episode of Health Tech Central.